Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome to Man the Post Weekend Review. My name is Dave and I'm joined by a man who is too sexy for his shirt, too sexy it hurts, Simon O'Regan. How are you, sir?
I'm not too bad, Dave. If I was a more cynical man, I'd suggest that was a crack at my membership of Bold Club, the right said Fred reference. I'm going to take it at face value.
Well, I was kind of banking on Carl being here as well to really... Because he would have been too sexy for New York and Japan, but I'm afraid he's missed out on that moniker.
As much of a banging tune as I think we'll all agree that they are in recent years, members of Christ and Fred have spouted a few political views that I wouldn't want associated with me. So, reference, let's go with the Mitchell brothers.
They're definitely on the back tail of Ball Club. Like they're not welcome at the forefront anymore.
Definitely not, definitely, yeah. So if you want a more modern reference, then the Mitchell Brothers, please.
Well, they haven't released any music that I know of, but...
You never know. Robson and Jerome did. Maybe there's a lost classic from France.
I mean, the bad table at Ball Club, which consists of those idiots and Howard Webb. I mean...
Danny Murphy. many more.
Danny Murphy, Danny Mills, the card carriers of... of Bad Ball Club. One of these days, we'll get... I'll wait for the day my inbox lights up and it's like ITV and it's like, we've heard you talk about Ball Club and we think it's a great idea for a sitcom. And I'm like...
I mean, I think that it screams more ITV2, I think.
I think it'd be fucking fortunate if it started with ITV, to be honest. But
anyway, this is a football podcast.
It is. King of the Balls, Pep Guardiola, kicked us off this week. His Manchester City team went to Crystal Palace, where another bald man gave Palace the lead in Mateta. And then a not bald person went ballistic in Kevin De Bruyne and brought the world back to sanity. City ran out 4-2 winners. Not a surprise in the end, sorry?
No, this is City fully engaged in, win every game mode. The dial has well and truly been switched into a championship winning form. I don't think even going 1-0 down, I can't imagine even the most optimistic of Liverpool and Arsenal fans thought, yes, this is the day that City are dropping points. And, once the equaliser came, I think everyone pretty much knew what was going to happen, didn't they?
I think so. I think you kind of got to defend for longer than 9 minutes. That lead was short-lived, really, wasn't it?
Only talking about defending for 9 minutes, and we'll come on to it in my God, I wish we could have defended for 9 minutes. But you're right, you do have to defend longer than that.
Yeah. Palace, I mean, obviously this isn't a game where... Palace weren't really the story here, but they appointed a new manager... who has won 1 in 6. No, but again, this isn't one I really expect them to win. But there's been pretty much no managerial bounce whatsoever from his appointment. I don't know anything about him. All he seems to have done is play with the back five instead of the back four. Have you noticed anything different about Palace? Or?
I mean, in true sort of man on the post form regarding Crystal Palace, other than the results on Saturday... it's only because we're talking about it now. I couldn't tell you who they've played in the last 6 weeks. I've got absolutely nothing on Crystal Palace. They are that epitome of a team you only notice when you play them. Really. Yeah. It sort of makes you think, was there any point in sacking Roy other than the fact that he was well past his sell by date? But you kind of think now, could they have given him to the end of the season, a proper little sort of farewell tour?
Well, I mean, there's got to be thinking about that now. I mean, you've got to think it's been pretty toxic. Well, it was pretty toxic in the stand, wasn't it? As far as Crystal Palace can get toxic. But, you know, they had fans carrying banners, Si, everywhere. So that's kind of implicated a little bit now by appointing a manager. I don't think probably 70% of Crystal Palace managers will have heard of.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're fans, probably not generous thinking that 30% had. Yeah, I mean, they're just... You almost feel... part of me kind of almost feels bad in a way because they're quite an inoffensive club, you know. It's not like I've got a problem with them and that's why I don't pay them any attention. It's just a kind of... Other than Elise Say and Eze, who have kind of been pretty much injured for most of the season, there's nothing exciting about them, is there, for neutral to kind of get behind. So, yeah, with the new manager coming in, I mean, would it surprise anyone if come October next season, he's sacked and...
Roy's back.
Roy is a member of the British manager club. and they're just a strange team, and the banners and everything that they had, they all, most of them seem to be kind of against the boards and the ownership as well, but I don't really understand what more they think Crystal Palace are ever going to achieve unless Saudi Arabia or Qatar for some reason takes an interest in them.
I mean, that would be a story in itself, but yeah, I think Palace currently sit as top of the bottom, if you like. Not necessarily the bottom half, but certainly the bottom tier of clubs, shall we say.
Yeah.
They're probably the last ones who could feasibly be relegated. I mean, Fulham are more than safe on 39. Palace on 30. I think they'll be all right from here, but you just don't know, because, as you say, they seem to stop existing after Christmas. Like, they just they have nothing to play for, and that's the end of that. I mean, they've won 7 games this season. When?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no idea. They, I don't see them having any problems in terms of relegation because they never do. They just, for a team that's kind of always in and around there, you know, you look this time of the season and they're always sort of within 4, 5, 6 points. But I never ever would seriously consider them as one of the teams that are in that battle and that will go down, and I think it's just going to be that way forever.
I think you're probably right. Considering we're going to talk much about Palace, they've taken up a fair chunk of this match, but there really is nothing to say about City. As you say, they're probably going to win, I'm going to say, nearly every game between now and the end of the season, if not every game between now and the end of the season. It's just what they do. I mean, they've got Luton at home next Saturday, so I don't think that's going to be a problem for them. And then after that, they won't play in the league again until the 25th of April, which is interesting. Because they've got Champions League and the FA Cup in between times. So by the time they go to Brighton on the 25th of April, we'll see how things look. But not the toughest game this weekend for them. We'll come on to the title rivals later on, because chronological order means we should really go through Saturday's games first. And let you go off the deep end about Villa 3, Brentford 3. Villa were cruising. They were 2-0 up in no time. No time, just after half-time. And then, out of nowhere, Brentford scored 3 times in 9 minutes. And then Ollie Watkins comfortably outjumped a static goalkeeper for 3-3, which was ludicrous. And we'll come on to the maddest incident of the weekend, which is Douglas Luiz managing to get his 10th yellow card in the 97th minute of the last game. He needed to avoid a booking in to get not suspended. So that was nice for him. Got big plans. Before then, that, though, how did this happen? How did you go from 2-0 up to 3-2 down in 12 or so minutes?
I still don't really know. I really struggling to sort of work out what happened still. Like, this game, there were only 6 shots on target in the entire game, and all 6 went in fucking the net. yeah, really odd game. Like, we were absolutely cruising. The first half, Brentford's, I mean, they were basically sat in the north stands. That they were that deep. They had zero interest of not even crossing the halfway line. That would have been a pipe dream. They didn't want to get out of their own penalty box in that half, which, you know, that's fair enough. That's their right. I think for us, a byproduct of how good we've been this season is that teams that will come to Villa Park now, and the ones that aren't as good as us, which is, you know, probably more than most in the league, they're going to sit back and make it difficult for us to break them down. And we did struggle for the sort of first half hour or so, but then we get, you know, decent goal, good ball in from McGinn. Watkins scored. Leon Bailey must have the best eyesight in history, because he seemed like how he had that level of confidence that ball had crossed the line. He almost like apologetically tapped it in as well, like in the way that he kind of thought, I'm offside, like I'm just going to tap this. So it was a bizarre little incident that. But that's, you know, get the goal just before half time, and then 137 seconds, I think it was, after the restart. You know, they're almost the 2 perfect times to score goals in the game. And yeah, absolutely cruising. And then just out of nowhere, Brentford's, their first goal was one of the weirdest like finishes I've seen for a while from Jorgensen. You know, has a swing at it with his right foot, hits his standing leg and sort of bobbles in. And you're kind of like, oh, okay, it's a bit of a kick in the knackers, but we'll, you know, maybe kick up the arse and we'll get going and get the third and finish it. But within 9 minutes, we've gone from 2-0 up to 3-2 down, and all 3 goals, crosses into the box with no pressure to stop the ball in, and the marking was awful. I mean, Carlos and Torres had really, really poor games, and then Konza didn't have a great game at right back either. And yeah, you're thinking then, oh, Jesus, how have we done this? If I was looking for a positive, is it at least we had a bit about us to go and get an equaliser, which keeps our run going of having not lost back-to-back league games all season, which I think is, you know, quite an underrated thing that we've done in the way, really. But there's no nice way of dressing up. It's definitely 2 points drops, and the second half of the season, we concede so many goals. And you know, Watkins after the game, you know, kind of said how there's been a few times that we've gone 2-0 up in games and just got complacent and sort of thrown it away, which part of me is kind of like, well, that's good that they're at least they can see it as well themselves, and they're, you know, they can acknowledge it. But a couple of months ago, when we almost cocked up a 2-0 lead at Luton, he came out and sort of said the same thing. So he kind of, some, you know, the site where we would be, this is brought up a couple of months ago and it's still happening. I think there's a number of reasons for it, and none of these are, I'd say, you know, can completely excuse and absolve the blame for, you know, the players still can and should be doing better. But I think, and what I'm going to say, our people will probably think I'm just moaning and go, well, you know, we all have injuries. But it is just true. We've had so many fucking injuries this season, and it seems every single week we'll get one person back and then we lose another player. We, you know, constantly having to change things around. And
sounds familiar.
People say, well, we all have injuries, you know, that's not an excuse. And as I say, that doesn't absolve Torres and Carlos from not getting anywhere near Mbeumo and Vista for their goals. But it does add to it. And another thing as well, which I said, I think, after the Man U defeat at home beginning of February when Kamara was ruled out for the season. I said then, I think that's our top four done. And we have actually kind of managed reasonably well since that. But in the 12 games he's missed for Villa this season, we've conceded two or more goals in 8 of those 12 games.
Mm.
And that can't be a coincidence. He's our only sort of designated proper holding midfielder. And I think our first 3 seasons back in the Premier League, we didn't have a really proper holding midfielder. And every Villa fan, we were crying out for one. And Kamara came in, and like, he's an unbelievable player. And so it's no coincidence that with him missing, we do look a bit more vulnerable. I also think because we're 6-7 games from the end of the season, and we're still in that top four race, and that goal is in sight. I think there's on a subconscious level from the players who aren't used to being in that position, that when you go in 2-0 up, you almost sort of subconsciously sit back and, drop a bit deep and get a bit more nervous. It's disappointing. At least we've come back and got something. And that's now 18 goals and 10 assists for Watkins this season. And it absolutely racks my brain that there's any sort of debate about whether he'll go to the Euros or not. Like, it's unbelievable that you wouldn't have him in there. And part of me thinks, and again, this is probably just my sort of annoyance and thinking that Villa don't get the credit that I think we should at times. If he was at Tottenham or Man U this season and scored 18 goals and got 10 assists, there wouldn't be any sort of debate whether he'd be in the squad or not for me. That's my rant over.
No, I mean, I'm fairly certain he will go, to be honest. I kind of understood Paul Merson's comments on this. And I know Merson comes in for a lot of flack, and probably rightly so, but for some reason I find myself agreeing with him quite often on some of these things, which probably says more about me than him. But he made the point that, like, if Kane gets injured, we're not going to win the Euros anyway, which is probably quite defeatist. And he said he'd rather take Ivan Toney if it came down to it, because if it went to a penalty shootout, he'd back Toney to score a pen. And if it comes down to a straight fight between the two of them, which I don't think it does, by the way, I think there's enough room for all three to go, then I can understand that point. But I don't think you can leave a man who's got 28 goal involvements out of the squad altogether.
Well, see, I mean, I think all three should go, and, like, because Marcus Rashford should be nowhere near it.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, but Southgate, he won't do that. He's going to take Rashford. We all know he will.
Yeah.
I honestly think that Watkins won't go and he'll take Toney, which is fucking mad. And the reason for that is, so with the Toney argument, if you're talking about a direct replacement for Kane, there's no doubt Toney is a much more similar player, and you'd be able to still play in the same way, which is absolutely right, and I'd agree with that. But you also, there'll be times, there could be occasions when you need to change something, you need something different, and that's what Watkins would give you. So I would take all three of them and leave Rashford, but I don't think that will happen, and I do think Watkins will be left behind.
No, I think you're right. But I think, you could play Kane and Watkins together if you're chasing a game. I don't think you necessarily play Kane and Toney together, because it's probably quite easy to defend against, really, at the highest level. Whereas, the old Kane will drop deep and play as almost a 10 if you need him to, and Watkins can stress the defence. So I think it'd be ludicrous not to take him. You saw him in the friendly against Belgium, like, he chased almost a lost cause in the last second to win the ball on the dead ball line and pull it back for Bellingham. And I don't think either of those other two would have done that. Not out of lack of willing, but lack of nimbleness to do that.
Yeah.
So
it's not their game. Like,
exactly.
They all have different attributes, and you're right. I think it would be insane to leave Ollie Watkins out of that England squad, because I think in terms of out and out central strikers, I think he's the second best centre forward in the Premier League behind Haaland. I mean, some people, there'll be people that will argue Toney, and there's, you know, there's arguments that you can make for that. There would be legitimate arguments, but on the basis of this season, I don't think there's anyone else that's been playing anywhere near his level.
No, that's it. I think I'd probably throw Isaac in the mix when he's fit, but he hasn't been consistent enough at that. So,
he kind of flips between through the middle and wide left. Like, I mean, well, do both really, really well.
Yeah, he did last season to accommodate Wilson, but there's never been a time where they've both been fit this season. We've never had that luxury, which is ludicrous to have to say that in April. But here we are. But yes, I think, you know, current form and obvious ability, I think Watkins has got to go. whether he does or not, who knows? We'll probably do a pod on England, I imagine, nearer the time, because I know you obviously go a lot of the England games, and I always say this, I'm quite passionate about the England team, especially around a tournament. I think you've got to be really, so I'm sure we'll fit one in before the European Championships this summer. So Villa momentarily kept fourth. They would come under pressure from Tottenham on Sunday, which we'll come on to shortly. We'll just round up a couple of the Saturday games. I mean, the Mighty Mags won again somehow at Fulham. It was a drastic game. I was actually in China on Saturday afternoon, so I was able to watch this match.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it was a nice little visit over there. Handily, Chinese TV shows the games with English commentary as well, which I didn't expect.
That's so very accommodating.
It is very, very accommodating of them. Awful game of football. We improved in the second half, and Bruno Guimarães gets better every week. Like, if we can hold on to him, you know, we've done really well, because I think he will get some attention from some far bigger clubs than us sooner rather than later. He was the match winner. There wasn't awful else to say. If you watched the FA Cup game between these two in January, it was basically the same match, where Fulham had all the pressure and all the shots, and we had all the goals. So, good for us. Keeps our European qualification hopes well and truly alive. Well, the results kind of went for us, which we'll come on to. Carl's not here to talk about Everton. Everton 1, Burnley 0 wasn't a classic by all accounts. But Carl won't give two hoots because Everton got the 3 points to add to their point they got at St James's on Tuesday. So 4 points gained and then 2 points lost today as the FA decided that was the punishment for them breaching the rules again. How have they landed on 2 points, Si?
Your guess is probably as good as mine. I've no idea. I think they're always gonna get something. I think I probably expected them to get the four.
Yeah.
Given taken that they were given back. Maybe they've just kind of thought, well, if we take four off them now, like whatever we do, they're going to appeal. If we take four off, we'll appeal it down to two. So let's just give them the two now, and they can go for the appeal, but we can sort of dismiss it easily enough by saying it's only two lads.
They should have a frivolous appeal process because, like, you know, when you used to like appeal a red card and they're like, you're taking the piss here, have an extra game.
Yeah.
Like, they should do the same for this because, like, if there's a chance to appeal, you're obviously going to do it if there's no repercussions. So, like,
yeah,
I don't know if it costs them any money to do so. Or, you know, I don't know what the downside of it is for Everton to appeal that because, like, obviously you're going to. I think they'll be quietly quite happy to only get an extra two, considering what it could have been. I mean, obviously the draw there was none, but realistically, if you're going to break these rules, which we're not going to do because it's an absolute can of worms, but I would say 2 points is a bit of a result.
I can only assume that Muric and the Burnley goal knew that they were going to have points taken off them today and thought, let's give you three.
He's seen Trafford flapping about for months and thought, if I can just prove I'm as good as my feet as he is.
What was that? I can't understand how that's happened. That's unbelievable. That's just ridiculous. And then What did you make of the red card out of interest?
I can't remember who it was now. How was that?
O'Shea.
Last man, yeah. Well, I didn't agree with what company said about, well, you've got to have control of the ball, because, like, you didn't have control of the ball because you got decked. And I don't think it's fair.
Had he been given a yellow, I don't think that would have been upgraded to a red.
Probably not. It's a tight one. And Burnley have had some stinkers this season, I think. Obviously, the one last week was bad. And this wasn't that much better, to be honest. So, yeah. A bit on the fence. I can see why I gave a red card, but as you say, had it been a yellow, I don't think anyone would have really complained about it that much.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
I mean, Carl would have complained about it because it's, you know.
Oh, obviously, yeah.
Something else Carl would complain about is Luton coming from behind to beat Bournemouth 2-1. Another late winner for Luton. They just keep finding ways to, keep finding ways to keep it interesting down there, because they don't seem to win that often, but when they do, it's never easy, is it?
No, it's not. If you go to games at Kenilworth Road this season, you are not leaving until full time. The amount of late goals sort of at either end has been quite astonishing, really. They absolutely had to win that game, didn't they? You kind of just sort of looking at their remaining fixtures. I mean, they've got Man City away next weekend, which I think, you know, let's write that one off. We've got Brentford home, Wolves away, Everton home, West Ham away, Fulham at home. So other than that Man City, they're not the worst last five games that they could have, really. It was vital that they won.
They tend to stay in a lot of games, don't they? I mean, obviously, they probably won't at Man City, to be fair, but certainly at home, they don't tend to get, you know, destroyed that often. They seem to give most teams a game. It's just, you know, quality usually wins out. But sometimes they can just scrap their way to a win like they did here. That game at home at Everton has potential to be very good indeed, isn't it? Maybe not in terms of quality, but in terms of importance. Everton's deduction today puts them back down to 27, which keeps Luton sort of within striking distance, if you like. Obviously, Luton have played a game more, but I think Everton's game in hand is against Liverpool, if I'm not mistaken. Not the easiest game in hand. So, right back in the melting pot. Bournemouth, on the other hand, their season's done, would you say? It was their first defeat in six, I think, which totally bypassed me. I didn't think they'd won so many in a row, but here they are.
They've had a tricky start to the season, which I suppose looking back now, you could say was, you know, understandable, because obviously it takes time for the new manager comes in trying to, you know, implement a different style of play with players who, you know, there's some okay players there, but they're not. You know, they're not top quality Premier League players, so it's going to take time. And they've sort of since mid October, November onwards, and they've been pretty decent. They've played pretty good football, which, I mean, to be fair, they kind of always have. Whenever they've been in the Premier League, they've always been a reasonably decent team to watch. I suppose the big thing this season is in Sri Lanka, they've got someone who's scoring a regular decent amount of goals. And that's why they're sitting very comfortably in 12th with seven games to go.
Yeah.
They've had a good season. I think they've got Man United at home on the weekends, which I think they'll be fucking licking their lips. I'm looking forward to that.
We'll talk about Man United later on, but they are absolutely. That's the thing about Man United. No, you don't ever fear playing them, do you? I mean, they're not definitely not the force they once were, to put it mildly.
I think Bournemouth, the start of December, they went up to Old Trafford, and I think 1-3-0, and it could have been 5-6.
It could have been 10-9, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So they're, I think they'll be looking back on the season thinking they've had a really, really good year. They're kind of, they're a more pleasing on the eye version of Crystal Palace in a way, really. That sort of where they're sitting in the table, probably the best that they could hope for. You know, 12th. Maybe they, with a really good season, they could finish the season 10th, which, to be honest, they could well still do this season. You don't know. But no, I think they've had a really good season, actually.
So it's mad to think if they'd won here, they'd have been joint on 44 with Chelsea.
God almighty.
I know. It's totally bypassed me that they'd won 4 of the last 5 before this game.
Yeah?
Fair play to Iraola, who, again, going back to October, November, we had them all pegged to be next sacked, or first sacked, I think it was at the time, because they hadn't won game at all, I think.
I think they got a really late win in the game before the international break in October, which probably saved them in a way.
Yeah, well, they've obviously come on leaps and bounds then. One to watch, because as you say, they've got quite a good young mix of players as well. Like, they could probably get more out of them if they keep them all together for a little while. But we'll see. Unfortunately, Bournemouth have always been one of these clubs who will probably have to cash in on a player or two.
Yeah.
Due to the size of the ground and stuff like that, they don't really have masses to play with, do they? But we will see. Where have we not been? Oh, right. Gary O'Neill losing his shit of the week. Wolves won, West Ham 2. Penalty aside, West Ham scored direct from a corner. Ward-Prowse's delivery going straight in, giving the assist to Hurricane Kathleen, I think.
Kathleen,
aye. Max Kilman heads in an equaliser in injury time, disallowed for offside. What's your take on the offside goal?
it's. I mean, there's no doubt that he stood in an offside position, but I think the sort of sound of match of the day, the sort of wording of the ruling is the player in the offside position either impedes the goalkeeper's ability to move, or is in his line of vision of the ball, and he wasn't. Like, Fabianski's watched that ball sort of all the way in from the corner and seen it land on the guy's head. So I think they've been really, not for the first time this season, as Gary O'Neill has pointed out quite repeatedly, I think they've been really, really harshly done by their, it's an absolute sort of ass of a law and a decision. When you go back to, is it Man City? I'm not sure if it was Bournemouth, though. They played someone up.
It was Fulham, and I was going to bring this up. I kind of agree with what you're saying. Like, when you've written the law the way they have, like, they're always going to give offside there, except the one time they didn't, Man City were, I think, drawing with Fulham at the time. And Nathan Ake stood on top of the keeper. I think he even moves a play for the ball, if I'm not mistaken.
He does, yeah. He swings his leg out
early. Yeah, and somehow that one's slipped through the net. But because Howard Webb and his mate come out and go, well, sorry about that, lads, we got that one wrong. That's all right. And then this one happens where, I think Lineker made the point of Match of the Day that I don't even think West Ham appealed for offside here.
Yeah.
I think, you look at it and you go, well, there's absolutely no way Fabianski's saving that. If the lad isn't stood in front of him, if he is in front of him, it doesn't make any difference to how that plays out. And you just wish common sense could be used in that scenario. But as you say, with the way the law's been written, it's kind of like, well, you're always going to get given offside in that situation.
I actually think the way the law's written, I think actually leads more to the argument that the goal should have stood, because if the player's physically impeding the keeper's ability to move or make an attempt for the ball, or if he's blocking his line of vision to the ball, which in this case he's not. Like Fabianski sees the ball all the way. That at no stage has he not been able to see the ball because of whoever has stood in that offside position. So this, from the way the law is written, it, as stupid as it is, actually gave them the perfect reason and logic to allow the goal to stand. And but yeah, I mean, absolutely ridiculous.
Well, Gary O'Neill certainly agree with you, as did half of the Wolves playing staff, it would have seemed. No one was very happy with how that one played out.
Yes.
But yeah. Wolves have had some shockers since, like, the first game of the season, really, when Onana cannonballed Cunha, was it? I can't remember who it was now. I mean, who it was irrelevant, but it was a mighty wallop anyway. And it's been downhill ever since, really, for Wolves. And I think Wolves had a pretty decent season and could have been even better. I think that's probably what would be the biggest frustration, is that, you know, a couple extra points here and there, and they'd be right up there in the mix for the European places. As it is, they're not out of it, but they're obviously got some ground to make up if they're going to get back into it.
Yeah, and you know, they have had sort of injuries to pretty much all of that. I mean, Neto, they've only been able to get him going for like 3 or 4 games at a time, and then he goes. Like, he's someone, ability-wise, could easily play, I think, for the majority of teams in the league, but his injury record is that bad. Part of me thinks he might still be at Wolves next season, because it'd be a bit of a gamble, I think, signing him.
Yeah, I think you're right. But when they had him, Huang and Cunha all playing, they were a real force to be reckoned with. Quite enjoyed watching them at the times this season. But as you say, shorn of those three for the last month or so has really put a hole in their campaign a little bit. But unfortunately, get a point here. So that ends the 3 o'clock games. There was a 5:30, of course. Chris, get well soon. You've got a poorly knee. His Arsenal side went to Brighton and won 3-0. And to be honest, it was very easy. Do you give credit to Arsenal for that, or Brighton poor?
I think you've got to give credit to Arsenal. I don't think Brighton played that badly. But they've just come up against a team that are just absolutely banging form, you know, at the moment. They're so hard to score against. Gabriel and Saliba have been excellent. And now you just Arsenal, I thought, just did, you know, really, really well. They get a penalty. There seems to be a bit of sort of consternation about whether it was or wasn't. My opinion, I think it was a penalty. I mean, I think Jesus goes down very easily, as he tends to do. But, they're trying to make the argument that Lamptey got the ball first, you know, which, okay, yeah, he does. But then he still, you know, fouls Jesus. And, you know, and if he doesn't, Jesus can probably still get to the end of the ball. So I don't have a problem with the awarding of that. And then, just with Arsenal at the moment, when they go 1-0 up, you kind of feel like, well, it's going to be very difficult to get anything out of them. And they went and finished the game off really, really well. So, yeah, I think you just got a full credit to Arsenal at the moment.
Yeah, as you say, very all-round away performance this. Once they got ahead, you always fancy to get another one on the break. Such is the way Brighton play, and such is the way Arsenal like to play. No argument with the result. I don't think anyone can really be vexed at how it turned out. Arsenal back at the top of the table.
I think the only bad thing that I have to say about Arsenal in this game was maybe Gareth Southgate's right not to have Ben White in the round, because that was, I thought that was a fucking disgrace.
Yeah, I did think that, yeah.
It's absolutely pathetic, and yeah, absolutely no need as well. You know, it's not like they're playing Liverpool, Man City, or, you know, the derby against Tottenham, where you feel you need to do something like that to get someone sent off and having to get an advantage. I just thought it was really embarrassing.
Especially against one of his old clubs as well. Like, I mean, I'm not saying, like, you know, take it easy on them, but, like, have some respect for them and not try and get a man sent off for no reason. Like, it's a bit pathetic, but he'd not be the only one, I'm sure. But
no.
Yeah, but unnecessary, I think, is the bottom line there. into Sunday, and some odd kickoff times. So the start of the day at 3:30. Man United and Liverpool played out another great game of football, in my opinion. Usually enjoyable when these two go head to head. Liverpool took the lead through Luis Diaz. They then spurned 100 chances, and Man United scored, I'm going to say their first chance, but their first shot from, from fully 40 yards went in. I mean, fair play to that crap weasel Fernandez. I mean, that's a great hit.
The technique is outstanding. Yeah.
Likewise on Kobbie Mainoo, who clearly just watched Makeda's goal against Villa, because it was identical.
I felt like a Vietnam vet having flashbacks. I was like, honestly, it was horrible.
Absolutely identical goal. And then Liverpool, you can't say undeservedly got a point, because they said probably did enough to win the game, really. But Harvey Elliott, who came on and actually did very well, earned a penalty on Wan-Bissaka, and Salah put it away to finish 2-2. Pick the balls out of this. What's your take on from this one?
I mean, Man U and Liverpool have played each other 3 times this season, and in those 3 games, Liverpool have had 87 shots. not won any of those 3 games. I don't understand. it's really, really strange. You'd say about Man U what we kind of seem to say every week, that they're absolutely dog shit. Like, they're one of the worst teams out of possession. I think they are possibly, maybe other than Sheffield United, the worst team in the Premier League. Like, they're so open and so bad. Yet they're sitting sixth still, and they kind of somehow get these ridiculous results from games that you've watched, and you look at the stats and you think, how have they not been done 4-5 here? Just so strange, this game. It's on Kobbie Mainoo. Whoever does his PR, I think, is outstanding. He's a young kid who has had, I think, a decent season with Man United. I think if he was playing for someone like Palace or Fulham, and have put the same level of performances for them that he's put for Man U, you wouldn't even have Palace or Fulham fans saying that he's been playing for England. I think it's strange the level of hype he's had. And you see it a lot with young English players when they get overhyped. What I hope doesn't happen to him, but I hope a really good football club doesn't come in and sign him, and it's too much too soon for him. You know, he'd be better off staying at Man U, solid mid-table team. No one's going to expect them to win anything. He definitely won't have the pressure of playing Champions League football. Just let him develop for a couple of years, and then maybe see what he's all about. But from a Liverpool point of view, I'm sure you know. We've done, you know, this is the last game with the 3 titles, so I suppose we can go on to sort of chatting about the title. Part of me thinks this might be a game they look back on at the end of the season with regret.
Well, I think this and the Man United home game at Anfield, where they, as you say, had 30 shots and no goals that day. It's bizarre, isn't it? Like, Liverpool obviously makes so many chances, but Mo Salah, like, he must have had 30 shots in this past 7 days or something. You know, like, every game they play, he seems to have all these chances, and I can't help but feel he should be doing better with some of them.
There's one just before half-time, wasn't there? Like, a little volley that fell to him, which, you know, 9 times out of 10, you'd expect to see the ball hit the back of the net, and then he'd blaze it over.
Yeah. It's, it is kind of unusual, but he's also always had this in him where he needs 5 or 6 chances a game, but usually scores a couple of goals. I feel like Klopp's patience is wearing a bit thin, because he obviously hooked him early on Thursday night, was it? Possibly with this game in mind, but it was 1-1 at the time in that game, and they took him off. Like, I just feel like they get a bit sick of a player who is obviously probably one of the best ever to play for Liverpool, but he's also one of the greediest players ever to play for Liverpool in terms of in front of goal. And ironically, you know, since Mane left, he's been a lot more happy to pass the ball, shall we say, and has quite a few assists, but his shooting boots have deserted him these last few games. He isn't the only one, of course. I mean, Nunez is Darwin Nunez. You know what he's like. He's always involved, but not always necessarily in a good way. But yeah, I think Liverpool will look back on this if they don't win the title, especially if they don't win on goal difference, which, as it stands, is the case. Now, I'm not saying for a minute that I think all them and Arsenal win every single one of the remaining games, but it's still 2 points dropped, no matter which way you look at it.
Yeah, definitely. I think, because for me, sort of looking at the three of them, that I've said all season, Man City, and I'll stick with that. I look at City's remaining games in the league. So they've got Luton home, Brighton away, Forest away, Wolves home, Fulham away, West Ham away, and then they've got a game away at Tottenham, which I think is yet to be rearranged. Other than that Tottenham game, like I look at all those other games and go, I can't. They're winning all of them. Like, I can't see them not winning all those games. And to be honest, I think they win away at Tottenham. I think they're the only one out of the three that I can quite easily see winning every game from now to the end of the season. So I do think City will win. I wouldn't be surprised if Arsenal won. I don't think Liverpool will, just because I think out of the three, Liverpool are kind of the most chaotic in their games, and I think they can be got at. Like, I think defensively, and their sort of the midfield structure, I do think there are issues with them that you can get at them. City, obviously, they can concede a goal or two in a game, but they just have that level of control that you just know that they can put 3, 4, 5 past a team. And then Arsenal, you look at them, they're the only ones who look like they're not going to concede many goals at all. So I think, for me, I think if come the end of the season, you're looking at it'll be one of City or Arsenal. I think it will be City, but it wouldn't surprise me if Arsenal did. Even though I actually think Arsenal, I think if you look at the squads, I think Arsenal have probably got the weakest squads in terms of quality out of the three of them, but they look like the most, that's what I'm looking for. They're certainly the most solid, but like it's more like the whole team is greater than the sum of their parts. Whereas with Liverpool, it's more real quality in their front line that they can just go and sort of take games away from teams that where you might not think that they're going to get anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think looking at the games, I would say Liverpool have probably got the easiest run in. Not that it's, you know, massively easy, but, you know, Palace at home, Fulham away, Everton away, West Ham away is a bit iffy. They host Tottenham, they go to yourselves, and they host Wolves to finish. I mean, that's not bad. Whereas Arsenal, I mean, granted, they've got yourselves this weekend, but I think without a central midfield, Arsenal probably have too much for you. They go to Wolves, not a problem. They host Chelsea, shouldn't be a problem. They go to Tottenham, with a big North London derby. And then after Bournemouth at home, they go to Man United, which is a huge game at that stage of the season. Whereas Man City, as you say, the games are... I don't think City will lose again, to be honest. Their hardest game is probably, well, as you say, the rearranged Tottenham game, which is almost certainly going to go in that second last slot of the season. Tottenham have given Man City some problems over the years. Granted, you know, obviously Harry Kane isn't there anymore, but even earlier in the season, would have finished 3-4 each. It was something hideous.
3 each, yeah.
Yeah. And Spurs do bring that chaos that it's almost like fighting fire with fire, isn't it, if you play like that against Man City, which we've made this point before, but Tottenham are going to end up playing almost the bare minimum number of games this season, which is, I think, they're going to end up playing 41, I think. City will probably play that in this year, this calendar year, like from January till May, they'll play a lot of games. So whether that's a factor or not remains to be seen, but it's the time of year where that sort of thing should start becoming a factor for Tottenham, and to an extent Chelsea as well, who play some of those teams, but they haven't had any European football either. So
yeah, so I mean, with City, I don't see it being a factor for Man City because they're just used to it. Obviously, yes. They did it last season, winning the treble, like with relative comfort and ease. To be honest, they're just kind of they're built for that. I think with Liverpool, I actually think their last three, Tottenham home, Villa away, Wolves home, I think that could be tricky because at that, hopefully. Well, actually, hopefully, it would have been well clear of Tottenham by fourth by then. But realistically, you're probably looking that Villa and Tottenham will probably both still be really fighting to try and get fourth spot. And so they, whilst there'd be tough games for us against Liverpool, there'll be tough games for Liverpool as well, playing the two of us, sort of one week after the other.
Oh, I mean, that's not great, is it? The other fixtures,
and they could still be involved in Europe as well, Liverpool, as could we.
As could you, yeah. I mean, that's the other thing I was going to ask you, is obviously Man City and Arsenal. Tough quarterfinals in the Champions Leagues. But I think I make them both favourites to get through where they'll face each other.
Which would benefit Liverpool, I think.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, do you see it being a factor? Like, it's obviously another distraction. It's more games against high-quality opposition who are going to wear each other out.
Yeah, I think I was listening to a little video from Jamie Carragher on Gary Neville podcasting after the game yesterday, and he made the point. He said that Liverpool will be hoping that both City and Arsenal can get through and face each other. He was just talking about his own experiences. They played Chelsea, and I think in a couple of Champions League semi-finals, and you're sort of saying it just played against another English team when you're both also going for the title in a semi-final, it can take a lot out of you. Now, obviously, as we just said, City are used to it. You know, they're sort of built this way. But I think if it will certainly help Liverpool more if they both get through than if one of them or both of them don't, just because it just adds that extra sort of big factor into it, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, as a neutral in all this, it's really, really interesting to see how all these things come together, because I can't remember anything like this where it's three teams who are more or less on an even footing, and obviously, you know, two of them on a collision course in the Champions League as well. It's a real humdinger, isn't it, to what we usually get this time of year, which is Man City are 10 points ahead, and it's like, when will they win the league? So.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Like, yeah, absolutely. It's makes it much more interesting. Like, it will. So we've had a couple of occasions in the last few years when, you know, City and Liverpool, it's gone down to the last game between them. It's getting to a situation, I can't remember off the top of my head, where you could get to the last game of the season, there's three teams that could all win the league. Like, it's so that, yeah, it does make it more exciting from a neutral point of view, definitely.
Kind of hope it gets to the point where all three of them are on the same points.
Yeah.
And if Liverpool and City can just close that goal difference gap as well, so they're all on similar goal differences, that would be the absolute pinnacle, wouldn't it, if we can get that to happen. But yeah, that's probably quite fanciful to try and get that scenario over the next five or six games. But anyway, something to look forward to. We'll round up the rest of Sunday's games. I mean, Tottenham beat Nottingham Forest 3-1. Fairly routine in the end. Forest did briefly rally with an equaliser. What did you make? Have you seen the James Maddison incident?
Yes.
How was he escaped a red card here?
Honestly, I'm speechless. I cannot understand for the life of me how you can look at someone fucking punching someone on in the stomach.
Mm.
And again, I really don't. There's no possible explanation that can be given for how we got away with that.
I just find it extraordinary. Like, you go back to Burnley's red card against Everton, it's like, well, all right.
Yeah.
It's borderline last man, but I don't know, dogs or whatever you want to call it. and then you get this obvious assault.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why we have VAR for situations like this, because...
Yeah, I mean...
One is clear and obvious and one isn't, and yet here we are. So.
You see, like, if someone pushes, even if just, like, gently pushes an opponent in the face, they're getting a red card. Yet you can punch someone and it's fine. Absolutely fucking ridiculous.
It's, I mean, I have to say, that Yates and Forrest is one of the worst players in the league. Like, and I mean that lovingly, because he's obviously better than you or I, but, like, every game I watch him, you know when, like, you play six aside and one team's short, so they've bought their mate who plays rugby, but, like, he's keen, but, like, he's, you know, not built for it. That's like him. Like, he's always off the pace. No matter what the game is, like, he's always, like, 2 yards late into a tackle.
Yeah. And he's a diving little prick as well. I don't know how he knows.
But, yeah. Nah, he's not great. But, you know, Forrest have got enough problems.
as they
sit 17th. And outside the relegation zone on goal difference. The final game of the weekend saw Sheffield United snatch a last-minute equaliser against Chelsea. Funny, isn't it? How football works after Chelsea scored their two late goals on Thursday night to beat Manchester United. This was Ollie McBurney's time to shine with a 93rd minute equaliser, I think it was. Chelsea just takes one step forward, two steps back all the time, isn't it? Like,
yeah. I mean, I haven't seen the highlights of this one yet, but I don't feel like I need to still
enjoy
just how fucking funny it is. I mean, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Like you say, their midweek game against Man U was like probably the funniest, most entertaining game of the season so far. But then it's almost like they thought, how can we top that? I don't know.
Got it.
It's just mental. I think Chelsea are just such, so average. Like, really. What more can you say about them? Like, just, I was just chatting as the game was going on, the WhatsApp groups, that were in one of the lads, a Chelsea fan. And in that, like, I was saying, I thought Brighton had done well getting 60 million for Sideshow Bob at left back off them. But they've managed to up that by getting 115 or whatever it was for Caicedo. Like, just their midfield, Caicedo and Fernandes, has pound for pound, one of the worst Premier League midfields. Yeah, it's £220 million of rank average ability.
Yes.
I
think it was last week we were talking, like, Fernandes played in the World Cup for Argentina and played more or less as like a holding mid, you know, not a very attacking midfield player anyway. And obviously Chelsea have tried to do that with him and gone, you know what, this isn't working, let's play a bit further forward, and gone, well, that's not great either. So,
yeah,
Conor Gallagher, if you can just run about a bit, that'll make up for it, and we'll figure the rest out later. And it's just like they haven't figured it out, and we're 30 games in. They've got so many players who are just nowhere near the quality needed for Chelsea. And it's not like you can say, they need a clear out, because they've just bought half of them.
Yeah. Well, like, most of them, they wouldn't be able to shift even if they wanted to, because so many of them have been given ridiculously long contracts. No club is going to, you know, be able to offer or match what Chelsea have been giving these players. So there'd be no incentive for the ones that they wanted to get rid of to sort of go anyway. It just really, really strange. And I wouldn't be surprised if if they ended up losing Cole Palmer in the summer, because, you know, he's had a good season. He's clearly a very, very talented player. He'll be wanting to play in, you know, at least the Europa League, if not Champions League football. And Chelsea are so far off anywhere near mounting any sort of challenge, I think, for the Champions League. So I think they might struggle to keep hold of him this summer. I genuinely do.
Yeah, well, I do wonder if you're Man City and you have a buyback clause in there. I don't know if they do or they don't, but like, and whether he would go back there or not is another matter. But surely, like, clubs of a European ilk will be looking at him and going, "Well, hang on a minute, we can offer European football here now." Obviously, he's young, he's got time on his side, but he must look at what's going on around him there and think, "This is chaos."
Yeah. Well, sort of interestingly enough as well on that, a couple of months ago before we played them in the FA Cup, one of the other lads I did the Hulkcast podcast with did a preview pod with a Chelsea fan who works at the club. I can't remember what capacity he works in, but he's been there a long, long time. And like for an employee of a football club, I thought he might have been a bit more smart about his thoughts on Todd Boehly and the new ownership. But he made the point that Cole Palmer, because it was in like 20-odd million or something they got him for. I'm sure he was pretty cheap, wasn't it?
Can't remember the exact price, but...
I don't think it was more than 30. So I remember being shocked at the price he bought him for. But this guy, he said that, and my mate who was doing the pub with him was shocked when he said this. He said Cole Palmer, they brought him into the club, but if he has a good season and they get a decent offer for him in the summer, then they'll sell him to make a profit. Like they've not bought him in thinking he's the long-term player, long-term future. He's bought in as so many, all pretty much. He's sort of saying that the strategy amongst buying all these young players is sort of an element of hoping that they will they'll realise this potential that some of them supposedly have and that have got really good players early on, but also that they've all been brought in as young players with a view to develop and sell for profit, and Palmer is part of that. So, again, I honestly wouldn't be surprised to see him somewhere else next season.
It says here they paid $40 million for him with $2.5 million add-ons, which seems like a pointless amount in add-ons, but still, $40 million, considering what they've paid for a lot of other players, is extraordinarily cheap. I mean, he won't have any shortage of suitors, I would imagine, if they were to sell him. But I'm surprised that he's included in that sort of flip for a profit type scenario. But we will see how that plays out. That rounds up all of the games. We kind of talk about the table as we go along, but the headline is the top three are separated by 1 point. Arsenal have 71, City have 70. And then back and forth in fifth, got Tottenham and Villa both on 60, but Spurs have a game in hand. At the bottom, Sheffield United have 16 points, Burnley have 19 points, Luton and Forest have 25, and Everton have 27, Brentford then have 29. So I don't think they'll be sucked into it, but they haven't won for many, many games now, Brentford, so must be getting a little bit worried about it.
Yeah, I think they will end up being okay. Their next three games are Sheffield United, Luton, and Everton. So I'm sure we'll have a better idea where they are at the end of April. But surely they'll win at least one, if not two of those games, you'd think.
You would think. They've got the quality to do so. I mean, Burnley and Sheffield United haven't made a habit of winning all season, really. So it would be a real surprise if they lost to both of those teams, if any of those teams. Anything else, Si? Any other business?
No, not that I can really think of. I think we've sort of pretty much covered everything.
Very good. Well, we will leave it there then. You can, of course, hear Chris and the gang later in the week on extra time. They'll probably round up those Champions League games we talked about, as well as looking forward to next weekend's games. Si, where can people find you on the internet to discuss things with?
So yeah, on Twitter it's at Si O'Regan, and for Villa fans or anyone interested in hearing our thoughts after Aston Villa games, it's the Hulkcast podcast.
Brilliant, thank you very much. You can find me on Twitter at CM9798. The website is CM9798.co.uk, and you can find the show on Twitter and all the usual socials at Man on the Post. Please remember to subscribe to us on your favourite podcast listening app. We're on just about all of them, including Amazon Music, so make sure you have us dialed in on that. Si, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Dave. Always good fun to do a podcast with yourself.
Oh, it's great to be back in action for no more international breaks for the rest of time. It's just a shame we have to wait a week until the next instalment. It's been a really fun season for the most part. It's always nice to come on and talk about the games. It's very rarely like clutching for stories. There's always something going on.
Yeah, definitely.
We'll be back next Monday. Will it be me? Will it be Si? Will it be Chris? Who knows? Someone will be back next Monday. Thank you very much for listening, and always remember to keep your man on the post.
Yours now, go out and take it all. You are the brightest star.